Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
General quarters. General quarters.
General
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder of those who are with us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. Also, if you're new to Midrats or if you want to catch up on the shows you've missed, you can always access the archive on the show page at Blog Talk Radio or take the easy way out and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. 10 years on from the attacks of 9/11, a lot of what you've read and heard today with the remembrances and really for the last few weeks in the buildup, at least from my point of view, has been based on emotion and remembrance of those who died that day and the wars that followed. And that's good, and that's important. But today on Midrats, we're going to use the other side of the brain and kind of step away back from the emotional and go more towards the other side of the thought process. And we're going to do it with an extended 90-minute format, and we're going to have a panel vice the usual interview. And there are certain points in the Navy's, not just the Navy's, the nation's history, that really define a transition from one era to another. And those moments are really clear, and everybody can kind of remember where they were on 9/11. Usually transitions aren't that clear when you're there until you look at it in retrospect. But in this case, I think we knew at the moment we happened that whatever the transition and change was going to have, that we were at a pivot point in our nation's history, not just our nation's history, but also internationally. And it was that global moment that I think made a lot of things, like a lot of people remember, if you're a Gen X or younger of a certain age, you remember where Reagan was shot. The boomers remember where they were when Kennedy was shot. And it really was one of those moments. And since then, our military's changed, our national security strategy has changed, and the way domestically that we see the trade-off between liberty and freedom has changed as well. And the ebb and flow of the international order has changed a few times in the last decade. So we're going to start today. We're going to look back at where our nation was from a national security mindset back on September 10th. And we're going to work our way forward through the decade to see how we've changed, how we've adjusted, and also where we think we may be going to next. And our panel to discuss today will be L. Thomas Bortnes. He's captain in the United States Navy. He's a research staff member over at IDA and the former executive director, Office of Intelligence, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, Department of Homeland Security. We also have James S. Robbins, senior editorial writer for Foreign Affairs at the Washington Times, author and contributing editor for National Review Online. We've also interviewed James in the past, for those who remember. He is the author of This Time We Win, The Tet Offensive, and also Last in Their Class, The Goats of West Point. Two great books if you haven't a chance to read them. And we also have another author with us, returning guest Claude Berube, Lieutenant Commander, USNR, and Instructor of Political Science at the United States Naval Academy, Intelligence Officer in the Naval Reserve, author, and former Senate staff member. As a side note, we're also going to have J. Michael Barrett on today, but for a reason best kept to himself, he wasn't able to appear today and join us this afternoon. We wish Mike safe travels, and we're going to have him on Midrats at a later date as well. So Tom, Jim, and Claude, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you, Sal. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
And Tom, I'm going to go ahead and throw the first question your way, and it kind of builds off on my intro there. If we look back at 2001, the decade prior to that, we were in 1991. That military that we and many of our allies that were with us had built during the last decade of the Cold War was used to liberate Kuwait during the first Gulf War. And as that was winding down, we were starting to digest what had happened. The paradigm had been with us for decades. The Cold War was starting to fade as the Soviet Union just began to fall apart and was in one of the various scenes in its final act. And the 1990s, the decade of the peace dividend, there were some hints of what to come. We saw a few attacks here and there, but we really weren't focused on the type of threat that came to greet us there in September of 2001. And in many respects, we were blindsided. And just to give people a little bit of perspective, if you could, Tom, kind of rewind yourself back to the 10th of September 2001. We had a new president, a new Secretary of Defense that we had just gotten through with a QDR, and there was an idea of the national security arena that our nation was going to be. And what were we looking at in the 10th of September 2001, something that we just left behind the next day?
Chief, that's all you want in 5 minutes? Okay, Sal. let me do that. To put this in context for the listeners, I had just taken over command of the Office of Naval Intelligence here in Washington, just coming back from Hawaii, serving as the intelligence officer on the Pacific Fleet, and then a quick year tour in the Pentagon, working on the OPNAS, on the Navy staff, or the CNO, and the Director of Naval Intelligence. But having just taken command, I think the best way to put it in context, we were coming off a decade where, you're right, there were a few indicators of what was to come. I was in Somalia in 1993. And then, of course, you know, as we followed events across the Clinton administration, both administrations, there were, you know, a number of events that rolled from preventing genocide, widespread in various parts of the world, none of them attractive. Kosovo, Bosnia, of course, first, and Kosovo, Macedonia. If you look at George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence then and the director of the CIA, his testimony on a worldwide threat back in February of that year, it's very interesting to look at the list of things that we were concerned about. Terrorism and proliferation, primarily of ballistic missile technologies and nuclear weapons, were at the top of the list. And that really hasn't changed. They're still at the very top of the list, even according to General Clapper, the new director of national intelligence, testimony in February of this year. So terrorism and counterproliferation were very high on the list. Also high on the list were the vulnerabilities of our infrastructure, particularly all those dependent upon the internet and in the cyber domain, which pretty much is most of our infrastructure, and the threats that could be caused to them, asymmetric threats, as we started to label them. There were still the issues of transnational crime. Narcotics was high on the list. Regional challenges, of course, didn't escape. But also on the list, he spoke, this would be George Tenet again, in February of 2001, spoke to a fair extent on state fragmentation, the collapse of states, and the opportunities that it provided a variety of groups, from the criminal to terrorist groups. So when I took over ONI, that was at the top of the list of concerns that we had. From the intelligence community's perspective, what was at the top of our list was an analytic workforce, and I think this goes with your question very well, an analytic workforce that was getting very long in the tooth. The average age was in the high 40s and up into the 50s. And how were we going to, have the sort of facile, agile minds that we needed to confront issues that were evolving? That was very high on the list. And I remember the defense side, as I left the Pentagon to go over to the Office of Naval Intelligence, one of the key issues was, of course, Secretary Rumsfeld having just come in under the Bush administration, and with a very fixed eye towards transformation, not only of the Defense Department, of OSD writ large, but of the military forces to confront a different kind of threat. And, of course, I'll conclude with saying that all of this was presaged by a decade of the peace dividend, purportedly, and, you know, how could we, in fact, scale back this massive expense on national security not just Department of Defense, but how could we scale it back appropriately, and then net the dividends for so many other things that, that had to be done that were foreseen to be problems. So I think those were the sort of issues that, that I was looking at as I came in September of 2001. But I'll leave this with one interesting briefing I received about the end of August, the first day or second day of September, which was a briefing on terrorism, particularly Al-Qaeda, and specifically because this was a maritime-focused intelligence entity. How did terrorists use the seas specifically? Did Al-Qaeda use the seas in any way, and how? And so that was something I hadn't given much thought to, but I had a very small group, particularly brilliant analysts, that had just started this nascent work, and I'll come back to that later because it impacted how the Navy, at least its intelligence component, responded to the attacks of 9/11.
Jim?
Well, it's hard to add to that comprehensive answer, but I can put in a few thoughts to add to that. One is that in the period before 9/11, particularly in the latter years of the 90s and the early 00, was the quest for the next peer competitor, I think, was something on everybody's mind, and there was a big focus on China as perhaps a rising threat. And China may well be a rising threat, but clearly not at that stage yet, not at that stage then, but nevertheless, when people were looking around for the types of threats that might be out there, who didn't want to just have the military be the people who went on humanitarian missions or stopped genocides, if they were even called genocides, because, as you'll recall, with Rwanda, we were reluctant to use that word. Nevertheless, that was a competing framework, which, of course, did not include anything about terrorism. In that period, and even before, in fact, for most of the Cold War, counterterrorism wasn't really cool. I mean, it wasn't really something that a lot of people made careers on. It was kind of a specialty item. And that's important to remember since 9/11, because since then, almost everything has been framed as the fight against terrorism or against radical extremism or something like that, an unconventional threat. And in fact, as someone mentioned before, the QDR came out right after 9/11. And you know, the QDR process had been going on for several years, and then suddenly at the last minute, it got sidetracked. And the document that came out was clearly a quickly kludged together work where you could see where they kind of tossed in. I mean, sometimes it was very blatant where you'd have a paragraph that was clearly written before and then something about terrorism was thrown in there. So there was a lot of quick reaction on the part of the bureaucracy to kind of say, well, okay, now terrorism is our thing. And suddenly everything was getting branded as a counterterrorism tool or a counterterrorism system or some other damn thing, whereas before it never would have been branded that way because nobody was really that interested in terrorism. It was kind of something on the sideline. It didn't involve a lot of appropriations. It didn't involve a lot of manpower. So in Washington, if something doesn't involve people or money or weapon systems, it's not going to get the same kind of attention. Another point to make is, well, it's kind of encapsulated in a headline of the morning edition of the New York Times from September 11th, Rumsfeld declares war. But what it referred to was the war on the Pentagon bureaucracy, ironically, and the relatively new secretary's plans for transformation, for downsizing, for radically reshaping how the Pentagon did business. And in fact, that summer of 01, when people were looking around at who was going to be the first Bush administration cabinet official to leave, people were looking at Donald Rumsfeld. And there was rumored to be a Pentagon pool already on the date of his departure. So looking back, particularly at the glow that surrounded him right after 9/11, when even, you know, feminists were saying he was so manly and commanding and stuff like that, things they never would have said under other circumstances, and things I'm sure they regret saying now. But, you know, it was a different world there before 9/11 in a lot of ways. And, you know, people forget the context of when terrorism wasn't that important, when Rumsfeld was seen as kind of a weaker cabinet member, a guy who wasn't going to get anything done. And all of that changed very radically when 9/11 hit and when the government responded to it. And I think when we start to talk about the next phase, about what happened, what changed all this, I think a lot of it had to do with the people we had in government, the way that they responded, and the way that they harnessed the national mood. Because, I mean, a national mood is a slippery thing. It can go one way or another depending on who's in charge and how they lead. And the Bush team were people who were very much committed to taking the fight to the terrorists directly. I mean, they understood immediately what had to be done and how this had to be characterized. And there wasn't any hemming or hawing or, well, maybe we can negotiate with the Taliban or, you know, there was nothing like that. They immediately knew from President Bush's first appearance on television and his subsequent major speech later that week. They knew exactly what had to happen. They conceptualized it perfectly, and then they acted on it. And that's really what changed things. So I give a lot of credit to that leadership. For, you know, some people say they took advantage of the crisis. What they really didn't do was let the crisis overwhelm them. They did what good leaders do, which is take something like that and turn it into a positive.
Claude.
Thanks. Yeah, just a few points, and I'll carry on from something Tom had mentioned about the challenges throughout the 1990s. It seemed like during the 1990s that we had finally entered into the Pax Americana with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And I remember that day actually very clearly. I was driving into work over at the Senate about 20 years ago, and thinking to myself, what's next? And that next decade, with us as truly the only superpower and a very strong economy at that point, although some may attribute it in some part to the internet bubble, but it seemed at the end of that decade that we were in pretty good shape. From a defense industrial base standpoint, it was kind of interesting to watch. I was a contractor for most of the 90s after that senator, and I still have a piece of paper from my investments of the mid-90s of about 12 defense firms that I had stocks in, and looking at those today, I think two or three of those still exist, while most of those were just subsumed over the course of the 90s. But you remember there were all these mergers and acquisitions that were happening throughout the late 1990s because of the sense of overcapacity that we had finally succeeded, and what we still had in terms of military forces could manage any crisis or any multiple crises that might emerge, whether it was in the Balkans or somewhere else. And Jim is absolutely correct about that political environment in the months leading up to September 11th, and especially about Rumsfeld. And one of the things that I remember distinctly was reading a Washington Post commentary, and it said something like, "So long, Rummy, we hardly knew ya." He really, Jim's absolutely right. People were counting down the days. I think in that there were some people who suggested that Ike Skelton might be replacing him, or they were already starting to figure out who Bush would turn to, because Rumsfeld had gone into the Pentagon. Although he had managed it once before, he had run a large pharmaceutical company, and he was going to try to bring business initiatives to the Pentagon to try to reduce budgets in terms of this new era. And some suggested that he might be going to the Army a little more heavily than the other services in terms of reduction. And that's what might have spurred a lot of the members to write a letter to Rumsfeld, suggesting that he might not do that. I had actually just come back a few weeks before from 6 months at Jack Molesworth in UConn, and I remember the Navy captain there at the time walking into our maritime branch And one of the sailors had asked him, you know, Captain, what do you think the next war is going to be? What do you think we have to really worry about? And I remember distinctly him saying Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And so that's that was really the first indication, even though Osama bin Laden had certainly declared war several years earlier, and there had been the World Trade Center and other attacks throughout the world. When you look at those attacks leading up to September 11th, the embassies in East Africa, the USS Cole, you know, I think there's a sense in the American public that we as military personnel overseas, or even State Department officials overseas, run a certain risk. And that changed on 9/11 because it wasn't just us at risk, it was the American public. And that sense of invulnerability, if you will, and the sense of freedom that automatically changed that on 10 years ago this morning.
Well, Jim, I'm going to ask a question that kind of comes off what Claude just talked about, since he was stealing my thought process. But really, I want to talk about the days before 9/11, when we had all these indications and warning signs that should have been evident to the media, should have been evident to our intelligence services, and we just didn't seem to connect the dots. From a media perspective, can you kind of talk about what was not seen and why we didn't see it, and where were our heads then, and what has changed since that time?
Well, I think a lot of that is hindsight. There are warnings
all the time.
I'm
just going to ask you that kind of question.
Yeah, well, you know, because the Bush administration got a lot of heat for that, like, you should have known. Well, after Gettysburg, one of Robert E. Lee's officers came to him with a series of points about what went wrong in the battle and what they could have done better. And General Lee said, well, I always encourage my officers to come to me with good ideas, but I prefer if you present them before the battle rather than after. It's a case like that. When you go back and look at various warnings that we might have had that something was going to happen, then, yeah, it becomes clear that we probably had enough information in the system to put together something. But the system wasn't working was part of the problem. Various firewalls between, you know, the FBI's domestic law enforcement apparatus and its intelligence apparatus, or between the CIA and the FBI's intelligence apparatus, or, you know, between various joint counterterrorism task forces that we had out there that weren't really communicating well with each other. You know, and the 9/11 report goes into this in some detail about all of the stuff that was out there, and if we could have connected the dots, it would have been better. But we couldn't, because other things were considered more important. This wall of separation between different intelligence units, or between the domestic and the foreign, or the fact that you couldn't set up on a mosque because it would somehow violate the First Amendment separation of church and state, or, you know, be some kind of civil rights atrocity or something, you know, who knows what. But things like that. There were various rules out there that made our system dysfunctional. And in retrospect, yeah, you know, we had all kinds of information coming in, but we couldn't put it together because the system wouldn't let us put it together. And that has changed since, and for the better, to the extent that we retain that. You know, 10 years later, it's starting to fray, and other walls are starting to be built. But I think that to say, well, we should have been able to do something, it's true, we should have been able to if we had a functional system, but we didn't. And it actually took the crisis to show people what are the consequences of paying way too much attention to one side of the pendulum and not paying attention to what you have this apparatus for, which is to keep this country secure. And once people understood that, and it was pretty hard not to understand that after 9/11, things came into a better balance.
Tom, I want to kind of expand that into the intel world, and I will say that well before the coal bombing and some other things, and I had a CO, I was CO of a unit in Washington, and one of my officers came in and gave a presentation to us on that threat that we could see, and he, like apparently the people that briefed you, mentioned the names Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and I must admit in those days I hadn't even heard of these people, but how did we not connect, since we knew Al-Qaeda had, was involved in the coal bombing and a lot of other things, Khobar Towers probably, the embassy bombings, how did we not connect that and make that a more important issue at the time? You got any idea?
Yeah, and I think Jim has hit a lot of the key points right on the head. The system just and the process just wasn't set up for integration. I think by September of 2001, we were clearly entering the phase where in the intelligence community we used to always ask, well, we don't know what we don't know. And so the grand the effort was focused on collecting more information. In my opinion, by September 2001, we had entered the point, and I think we're still in it, where the question more appropriately put is we no longer know what we know. By that I mean, for different reasons today than in 2001, we were at the point where we were bringing in so much information that clearly anybody going back in retrospect and going through, knowing what they were looking for, were going to find a variety of things to point to. There wasn't a lot of emphasis, particularly in the maritime piece of intel that I did, on Al-Qaeda. And its use of the seas. I mean, it was coal was the jarring thing that brought a lot of our heads around, and we started to take a hard look. But even by September 2001, the coal was, what, October of 2000, when I took over at the Office of Naval Intelligence, it struck me that nobody was seriously working. Well, okay, how did Al-Qaeda do this? Did they really do it? How did they do it? And what's their past experience in all of this? I'll go into that more in time, but the point again was the emphasis was on a different syllable. Even coming back, for instance, from the Pacific, it was hard for me, where we worked very hard, as you can imagine, while I was still on active duty, on an evolving China, and particularly, you know, our commitments as a nation to Taiwan. It was hard to get people's interest on, listen, hey, look what's happening over here. And by the way, we've got more gaps in terms of intelligence than we have solid information. So let's get focused on doing things. Perhaps maybe we're a little too aggressive in phrasing it as let's do things like we did against the Soviets. However, there wasn't an awful lot of political will to have an additional problem in the Pacific, particularly one with a growing economy like China's and its distinct relationship to ours, and how much we were dependent on them in terms of imports. Again, as Jim had pointed out, the system, the process at the time, were focused on things that now, of course, don't seem all that important, but I can remember distinctly a key issue in the intelligence community writ large was we have all this information coming in, new waves of collection platforms, all from miles in space, all very relatively sterile, but we really don't have the analytic workforce or the automation crunching power, believe it or not, to go through all of this in a timely fashion. And then even more importantly, what I realized after I retired from the Navy and went over to federal law enforcement, building a new intel capability for what had become U.S. Customs and Border Protection, was the absolutely vast amounts of information available in the law enforcement world, particularly the federal law enforcement world, and they had neither the manpower, the resources, dollar-wise, the people, the trained analysts, certainly wasn't their number one priority to move it over and share it with the larger national security structure. It just wasn't there.
Claude, what do you have to say to this kind of topic? It's pretty open for you at this point.
Now, I always am concerned that there's, especially in the media, there tends to be a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking in terms of intelligence analysis. There's a lot of good people out there with using the resources that they have. But when you're talking about interagency cooperation, certainly it did change a little after 9/11, you know, especially with the training opportunities for intelligence analysts, where you could have somebody, say, from the Navy working in a couple of weeks with folks from FBI or DHS or wherever, or excuse me, DIA at the time. So that was clearly a benefit. The Intelligence Reform Act tried to prevent some of these firewalls and tried to help this information sharing. But I think we're always going to have some sort of either bureaucratic infighting or a certain degree of rice bowl mentality in the future. And competition between agencies, while we're all Americans, is simply an unfortunate consequence of human nature, as James Madison might have pointed out in Federalist 10 with different factions for all different reasons because it's simply our nature. I think that, you know, there was something Tom said that was really interesting and about the lack of terrorism resources because we were so focused on so many other things. And because now, over the past decade, we've invested a lot into terrorism, looking out toward the future, I wonder what that next issue is going to be, that maybe we're maybe only 1 or 10 people out in the entire intelligence community are looking at and is going to be the next thing down the pike. And I think that might be the real danger in the future.
Claude, just to roll a question back at you your way, shifting it a little bit, is, you know, we had our attack on 9/11, but in the course of the decade, the Spanish had their pre-election attack in March of 2003. Also in July of 2005, there was a big London bombing, and their reactions were a little different. And I think the European versus the Anglosphere view, you can kind of break that out with actually using NATO's own numbers. If you look at, as a percentage of GDP from 2001, which of course those budgets were created before the attacks, and then 2010, which is pretty good because that's before the big crunch in Europe really set in from a budget point of view. If you look at our military budget versus them, and I'm not going to obviously go through all of them, but just to pick some of the players here, in 2001, as a percentage of our GDP, we spent 3%. And again, these are NATO numbers I got off their website. In 2010, America's spending 5.4% of GDP. That's an 80% increase. But if you look at the home of NATO in Belgium, in 2001, they were spending 1.4. Now they're 1.1. That's a 22% decrease. The Dutch, 13% decrease. The Germans, 7% decrease. And the French, even, it went from 2.6 to 2.0, a 23% decrease. The only of our traditional allies in NATO that have actually made some modicum to help us in the last 10 years without a lot of caveats are the British and the Canadians. The British budget, in spite of a lot of the cuts that they've had in their operational forces in last year, actually went up 8%, and the Canadians went from 1.2 to 1.5. Doesn't sound like much in our context, but that's a 25% increase. What is going on with the European response, especially when you consider their proximity to a lot of these countries that harbor Islamic terrorists and many of the cells that they have there? Do they see it less as a military challenge, or is there something else at work here?
I think they see it. Well, first of all, Europe is a real problem. Quite simply, they don't have the money. And what money they do have, they really have to continue spending on domestic programs in the foreseeable future. And I think we've started to see with Greece and other countries some of the problems that are emerging out of that, especially with regard to defense spending. So when we look at a new era supposedly cooperative engagement, it's going to be really tough for us to find people to cooperate with if they don't have the resources, which is unfortunate because they, you know, a lot of these countries have had just absolutely wonderful militaries, and while we do have good working agreements with them. The future does not bode well in terms of military resources for them, particularly since they have some more domestic population issues, and I think that really emerged a few years ago, was about 2005 or 2006 with the Mohammed cartoon, and I think it's the first time people really realized how many potentially radical elements were within these countries. I think in Lyon, France, something like 15 or 20% of the population is from North Africa, and while they needed immigrants to help with their workforce because their own domestic demographics were declining, they've started to see those problems. I mean, Angela Merkel and others have mentioned the problems of trying to integrate vastly different populations. In terms of Canada, that's a little different. Number one, Canada's economy is relatively strong compared to the rest of the NATO countries. They also have something that's very different in terms of terrorism. They have actually a pretty long history, going back to the 1960s with the FLQ, that was the Liberation Front of Quebec. And they had operated, they'd done a lot of bombings, kidnappings, and murders of public officials. And that had culminated in 1970, I guess it was, with the War Measures Act that then Premier Elliott Trudeau implemented, and there were Canadian forces taking to the streets of Montreal and Quebec. And they rounded up about 500 or 600 folks back then, and got rid of the FLQ. Some escaped, I think, to Cuba at the time. But so Canada has a real strong sense of history when it comes to terrorism. More recently, of course, Med Rassam, who was involved with the Millennial bombings in late 1999. Probably one of the better examples, in 2006, the Toronto 18, where Canada uncovered another major plot to conduct attacks against government buildings and potentially assassinate folks like Stephen Harper. So I think it's they have a different mindset, and they have a stronger economy, in short.
Jim?
Well, I think part of it is that they don't view it as a chiefly military threat, but as another type of threat. And bearing in mind that even before 9/11, the United States spent more on defense than the rest of the world combined. I mean, you know, we're the preeminent defense spender in the world. I think that's gone down a little bit now. We may not be 51% of the world's defense expenditures anymore. But, you know, the European states see it differently, and they see it more as a law enforcement problem, more of an intelligence problem, and they're not used to responding to things as mainly a military threat anyway, not since the end of World War II. So that explains part of it. I'd be interested to know what their other budgets did, you know, intelligence, law enforcement, and so forth. I mean, the British had long experience with counterterrorism, dating back for forever, probably in the Empire, but I'm thinking more of the time of troubles with Ireland in the 1970s and after that. So it wasn't like they didn't know what to do or how to lock down their domestic situation, and they've been pretty good at it. Also, in the case of Britain and France in particular, they don't face some of the same constitutional issues that we face in the United States. Which is not to say that they don't have civil rights in their country, but some of the technical aspects of how our courts have determined what our intelligence and law enforcement communities have to do to cooperate just don't exist in those countries. So they can stand things up more quickly and inexpensively, so the dollar amounts may not really tell the tale. I think that, as we've seen recently with the shootings in Norway, and other stirrings of a response to what's going on in Europe amongst some radicals on the right, their situation is a lot more complicated than ours in that respect. They have more radicals in their population, other than, I'm thinking Muslim radicals, and now they're starting to see both, I don't know, the non-violent but right-wing parties gaining more votes, and then stirrings among groups, you know, skinheads and neo-Nazis and things like that, who've taken a very explicitly anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim platform. So it's going to get tougher for them in a different way than for us, because they're going to have to cope with a more strident rush to the extremes than we're facing in this country, regardless of what people think about the Tea Party. But, you know, that's not what I'm talking about. And I think that they're going to have to respond to that if they want to maintain stability within their countries and reach some kind of political solution to whatever their problems are. But when you have the leaders of Germany first, and then France, and then Britain, saying in turn that multiculturalism has failed, that people are going to have to start to adapt to being part of the country in which they come to live, you're seeing a response at a deeper level, I mean a philosophical level, of saying maybe there's something about being a German or being French or being British that needs to be preserved and can't just be overwhelmed by the circumstances of who happens to show up one day, that there is a root definition of what these nationalities mean and that it's something that these countries would like to defend. And we don't have that as much in this country, because being a nation of immigrants, the United States has always evolved and we've had our own evolution in that respect. But when you have the leaders of countries start talking about that explicitly, then I think that you're seeing a reaction that's much deeper than just what do they spend on defense. It gets down to the level of they might start changing their laws to start pushing people out. And given the stresses on the economy and high unemployment, those tendencies will probably be exacerbated.
Tom.
Yeah, Jim, again, has hit a lot of the key points very clearly and distinctly. I was going to say the same thing. It would be good for Sal's comparison there about defense budgets dropping, et cetera, to compare the increase in, to see if there is an increase in police and intelligence budgets. And I would assume that there were. My work, both in uniform and then in DHS, with a number of European nations, I watched, we helped, we discussed with, we learned from a lot of the efforts that are conducted in the UK, in Holland, Germany, France, Interpol remembers headquartered at Lyon. So several trips there reinforced Claude's comments for me. But again, back to the cultural issues in Europe are dramatic. I mean, in a large number of years of guest workers, and that's more or less how they were viewed in a variety of countries, and then the sort of the imminent right of former colonial, the peoples of former colonial nations being able to emigrate to Europe, to England, for instance, in particular, and to France. You have these vast populations of essentially non-assimilated folk who weren't viewed for decades by the Europeans as French or as English. You layer on top of that decades of sort of this multiculturalism and the enforcement and by regulation, by law, by statute in places like the UK especially, to the point where you have serious discussions, and in Holland, let's not forget the touch problem. You have these problems of, geez, you know, well, okay, well, it seems only right that we'll allow Sharia law to exist side by side, sort of almost local autonomy or home rule, to apply the old Irish answer, in the UK. And this went on for a long time. So as Jim has said, it's very hard for these people, particularly since they're these people, for the European nations, particularly because they're dependent upon these populations for their workforce. They're in a much more difficult position, I believe, than here, where I think the vast majority of immigrants to this nation, although certainly not all, for, I think particularly in recent times, you know, view this as hey, we're going to the United States, we'll become Americans, we're staying here. It's not just a workplace of convenience. It's all part of the grand global effort. That may be changing more now, and citizenship here might be becoming, and again, just my opinion, more viewed globally as sort of citizenship of convenience. We'll go, we'll work, we'll become American citizens, but then we'll go home when it's over. I still don't believe that's the predominant view of immigrants here. But you certainly, have these kinds of problems in Europe. And I can tell you, the law enforcement folks there, they're, again, certainly not bound by the same restrictions that the law enforcement folks here, the intelligence community in the United States, is bound by. And, they are very aggressive. And I think nowhere is that better stated than in the UK with their ability to link law enforcement from the local level to the national, federal, UK intelligence structure, and to do that quickly and effectively.
And just I'm sorry, go ahead.
So we're catching up, but that's a discussion for another question.
And just a reminder to everybody that is joining us live, you're with Sal from the Blog Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak, Midrats. Today's panel consists of Tom Bortmus, Jim Robbins, and Claude Berube. We're going to take about a 2 minute and 45 second mid-show break. And just a reminder, we'll be going 90 minutes by 60 minutes today. So we will see you back in a little under 3 minutes.
This is a story of the Battle of the Atlantic, a story of an ocean, two ships, and a handful of men. The men are the heroes. The heroines are the ships. The only villain is the sea, the cruel sea that man has made more cruel.
Look like now, number one. It's the firmest contact we've ever had.
There's some men in the water just about there.
Well, there's a U-boat just underneath them. Attacking, stand by.
Target moving quickly, right, sir.
Range 200. Range 100.
Hasten to say it's a go, sir.
Kind of war, number one. The people in it have got different, too.
In what way do you mean that?
In the beginning, there was time for all sorts of things. Understanding people. Making allowances for them. Now the war doesn't seem to be a matter of feelings anymore. Now it's just a matter of killing the enemy.
Getting these diversion jobs nowadays, don't we, sir? Sort of compliment, I suppose.
Pretty cold one.
Cold night, too. Cocoa's just coming up, sir.
Gentlemen,
sir,
call up Cyprus on RT, plain language. Say torpedo 15 miles astern.
Aye, aye, sir.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Sal and Eagle One. Questions back to you.
Tom, I've got a question for you that is probably going to be vague and rambling like a lot of my questions. But I was reading this morning during some of the analysis done by people looking at what's happened since 9/11 that in their view, Al-Qaeda and some of the terrorist groups have ended up gaining more than they've lost as a result of our reaction to 9/11. And by that they mean that there are, I guess, some groups that we've kind of ignored as in our pursuit of Osama bin Laden and some other entities, and as a result we see what may be more radical groups taking over governments of Arab countries. Do you think that's true in any way? And if you do think it's true, why is it true? And if you don't think it's true, why do you think it's not true?
Well, I think Richard Clark, in a piece, I've forgotten where it was here recently, made that case very strongly. No, I don't believe it's true. I've read several pieces, op-eds today, where people said, okay, look, Al-Qaeda is at least the Al-Qaeda we first started working against. Its global reach has been severely limited. The leadership has been taken out. Probably the worst job in the world today is the number three head of operations in Al-Qaeda. You're not going to be there long. They wake up every morning wondering if when they poke their head out of a hole, if a drone is going to be there, a predator with a hellfire, or if the special forces are about to show up on their doorstep or cave entrance. There have been a lot of successes against Al-Qaeda. Now, on the other hand, that's core Al-Qaeda in the Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas in Pakistan, and, of course, in Afghanistan, the base is gone, more or less, almost entirely gone. Now, there are other groups, affiliate groups, that are spreading out, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, that are picking up the slack. And there are, as we've seen recently, any number of plots, from materials from bin Laden's death to things that are being recovered in the fight in Yemen. The Yemeni Navy just a week or so ago sank a suicide boat manned by, they have stated, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula members. They don't give up. They haven't stopped. They have a group that there are plenty of disaffected folks around the world that their ideology sells and plays well with. There are new recruits. They are not stupid. And they will continue. Now the question is the threat eradicated? Absolutely not. Did we do more harm than good by going after them? I don't believe so. I don't know how, if you are in the national security business, particularly in the defense. I mean, there's a threat and you have to eliminate it. And we've done that, I think, in a not without problems, not without some perhaps mistakes, but we've gone after it in a rational way for the most part, and I think the successes are clearly there. So, no, I don't like that kind of – I don't agree with that sort of Monday morning quarterbacking or those kinds of calls. We make mistakes. I don't know a war where we haven't made mistakes or anyone else has ever done them in the conduct of a fight. Perhaps we need to ensure, and again, Jim, this is your arena more than mine, that everyone understands that fights like these are not without mistakes. They're not without costs. They are always expensive, and they always demand things that seem inhuman. But we didn't begin the fight.
Claude, what say you?
I'd agree with Tom, absolutely. When you look at Al-Qaeda as an organization and the number of operatives and its leaders that we've killed over the past killed or incarcerated over the past decade, that it certainly is not a win for them. We've become better from an intelligence gathering and strike capability with regard to terrorism. We've disrupted a lot of plots over the past decade. By my count, about 40 publicly known plots have been uncovered, and including the ones in New Jersey and throughout the United States. If you were to take the other side then and see where we may not have done as well, again, Tom makes a great point that in any conflict, there are fits and starts. If you look at the terms at this war in terms of cost of money and lives, he's right that we spend money in every war, and there is an unfortunate consequence of war, and that's the loss of life. But as I'm sure Jim could probably point out better than I could, and you certainly don't want to lose any lives, but compared to other wars, the number that we have lost as a result of this global conflict is far less than, say, your average World War II battle, which we have tended to forget. Jim wrote a really interesting piece years ago, and I can't remember when he did it exactly, and I apologize, but it really struck home for me that there was a reporter who from one of the major news networks, maybe, who was talking to the Pentagon saying, is it 2,500 yet? Is it 2,500 yet? And it was almost like they were looking forward to hitting that threshold as if the 2,499th death was any less significant than the next person. And I think that's unfortunate in terms of war and how the media has come to respond to the conflicts that we get into. I think another way they may have not necessarily won, but certainly gained an advantage in the short term, is how they've changed our culture in terms, especially with regard to travel. Go into any airport today, and for those of us who are around certainly before September 11th, we know significant differences. I spent two times on the Hill in the early 90s and again about 7 years ago, and one of the things that struck me was how this fortress mentality had dug in on Capitol Hill and so many other places where you could just drive up to or just walk into without giving a second thought as a citizen or as a staffer, had changed demonstrably after 9/11. And I think that's something that's unfortunate, because when I think about my students, especially the ones who have just come in, the plebes, they were in the third grade when 9/11 happened. And so they've become accustomed to this. They know it's kind of a discomfort for their lifestyle, but it's something that I'm concerned that they will become so accustomed to it, they will not understand or will not live as we had lived prior to 9/11. So my hope is that we eventually get back to that point.
Jim?
Claude, that article you mentioned was from 2005. There was a National Review online entitled "Sorry, Wrong Number."
Yeah,
because it was about the passing the 2,000 death mark, and how the left was putting on a big show about it, but in fact, their count was wrong, and the Pentagon count had 1993 dead. But just it was about the general morbidity of discussing that and why it was such a big deal and why round numbers have such a fascination for people who want to follow this thing and how you define who's a casualty and a bunch of other stuff. But in any case, just thought I'd point that out. What was our question again? I got kind of sidetracked.
The question is that there have been a number of opinion pieces I've seen recently that kind of indicate that the authors feel that the terrorists have won in some ways. I claim Claude makes a good point.
About
travel.
Yeah, the terrorists are winning, or we did exactly what they wanted. Everything's going according to plan, et cetera. This is a ridiculous argument. I can tell you for sure it's not going according to Osama bin Laden's plan, because he didn't plan to be dead right now. Maybe he planned to be the caliph of the United Ummah right now. I don't know exactly what his strategic timeline was, but I don't think, dead was, a bullet point for 2011. So when you really have to compare what they had before 9/11 and where that could have gone, what was that trajectory vice, maybe some minor successes that they have now. Because before 9/11, they had a safe haven in Afghanistan with a friendly government that was its own, you know, caliphate, the Taliban. They had a training system where they could recruit and bring in people from all over the world, train them up, give them some practical experience in Kashmir or in the Balkans or someplace, or North Africa. They, you know, they could, they had a system of finance that was undetectable, where they could smuggle in diamonds or what have you, various types of money that they could get to fund this whole operation. They had easy global reach for almost anything they wanted to do, and they had a plan to, you know, take the world down. So when you think about how that could have developed and where that could have been now 10 years later if things had worked out differently for them, it's pretty impressive. But compare that, where they could have been, with where they are. That's the real difference. I mean, that's the real indicant of the impact that the United States has had on this war. And, you know, they're really not able to do practically any of those things anymore. It says a lot when Al-Qaeda is saying to Americans, don't contact us, just do lone wolf attacks on your own. You know, don't even try to do the old style things that we used to do. Our strategy now is that we want you, you know, American, you know, sympathizers, terrorists, to just go out and attack something. As they were recommending, you know, outfit the front of your pickup truck with some spikes and drive into a crowd, or what have you. It tells you that they've completely given up on any kind of integrated training and outfitting, equipping, planning, and targeting, and all that good stuff. They've given up on that. They're just saying, what we want now is chaos. Just go do stuff. And they're basically pleading with American extremists to become violent. And just, you know, please go attack the great Satan, because we can't, is what they're saying. And if nothing, you know, that should be a great indicator of victory for us. You know, or certainly on our way to victory, if they can no longer mount the kind of spectacular, you know, multiple attacks, centrally planned, trained for over a long period of time and so forth, if they've given up on that, then they've really given up on the kind of war that they thought would result in victory. And now they're just going for things like a pinprick here, some media coverage there, and all that kind of stuff, which is a problem, no doubt, and something we need to be concerned about, but not anything that will lead to their victory. I mean, don't measure them against our concept of victory. When you're talking about them, measure them against their concept of victory. And they are a long damn way from anything that even looks like victory. Particularly Osama bin Laden, who, you know, someone might say, oh, he was prepared for martyrdom and a bunch of garbage like that. Yeah, no leader like that is going to be a martyr on purpose. If he wanted to do that, he could have done it a long time ago. It would have been easy. So,
and, you know,
they haven't won anything.
And, you know, Jim, you know, what you mentioned is actually, you know, one of the goals that we had in this that, you know, some people kind of derisively snorted at, you know, the flypaper strategy of let them come here so we can kill them, but also to get them so focused on survival where they are that they were too busy to really lash out in a large-scale attack in multiple locations. So, that's really kind of a good news story. But in order to do that, a question a friend of ours, Lucian, brought to me. I'm slightly modifying it here. But in order to accomplish that, we have some very important but an ongoing low level of conflict that's required. And you talked a little bit about the, you know, the morbid number dance, which when you compare it to the average day on Okinawa or what we had on the Western Front of either World War, it is low level. But not unlike the British experience from the end of the Crimean War to World War I, how do we keep our national focus, both as a military, politicians, and civilians, focused on the importance of continuing to do this? Jim?
Well, good question. I think that part of the problem is when you're successful to a degree in contesting these unconventional conflicts, people start to lose focus. I mean, other priorities come up. Right now, the Defense Department, according to someone I was talking to inside the building, the Defense Department sees the upcoming debate over budget cuts as an existential crisis. Like, if we, you know, we're talking now about cutting defense to the point where it's going to be a serious problem. So, you know, because the times are tough, we have a president addicted to deficit spending who's driving the country into the ground. Okay, that's another show, I know. But nevertheless, the point is, where are they going for savings? And it's defense. I mean, the agreement that was reached on the debt ceiling through the automatic cuts into the defense budget. Now, I know that was in part a way to motivate people through fear, but it's also working. People are afraid of it. And it's hard to maintain that kind of commitment because you basically are a victim of your own success. As I like to, I give a lecture sometimes on when you look at when do you know the war is over, what would be indicants that we could finally say the war on terrorism is over? And the most important metric is there's nothing happening. You know, when nothing happens, you know you've won. But there was nothing happening on September 10th. You know, there was no attack on that day, but then the next day was a very bad day. So if nothing's happening, if everything starts to get quiet, maybe the enemy is just putting us to sleep. We don't really know. I mean, it's not like we've occupied their capital. As George Bush said, the very week of the attack, you know, this isn't a regular war. We're not, there's no lines on a map. You know, it's not going to be a ceremony on the deck of the USS Missouri, something like that. We just don't know when it's over. And, you know, it'll be when the enemy is degraded to a point where, you know, they can't do the things that they used to be able to do. But that's true now. And if you look at the metrics of victory in our first counterterrorism strategy, the one that came out in 2002, we've basically met all of the original metrics for victory. There were things like, so the threat of terrorism does not define our daily lives. So the, you know, the use of terrorist violence is discredited, stuff like that. And most of those metrics have already been met. Now, I know we came up with new strategies, but our new strategies are written with objectives that are actually unattainable. Things like, we're going to deny terrorists sanctuary in any country, or we're going to deny terrorists access to WMD. And there are other objectives in the latest strategy that are phrased like that. Well, how do you know when you've denied terrorists access to WMD? It's never ending. I mean, that's not a real objective. That's more of a state that you want to maintain forever. It's not something that you can accomplish and then move on. So we've kind of defined ourselves into a situation where we have to have an eternal war on terrorism. And that's just not going to be sustainable because people won't take it seriously over time. I mean, war has a beginning and an end. You know, not to get too much into Thucydides, but war is a very specific state, you know, in which people band together to commit intense acts of violence in pursuit of very specific objectives. You can't just say war is this continuous management process where we're going to manage global low-level violence forever. You can't call that war. We need a better word for that. And we're going to come to a point very soon where, well, the administration's already kind of abandoned the, you know, trappings of war. Now it's a struggle, you know, as opposed to a war. And they've kind of given up on the word victory as well. And in a way, that annoys me But, you know, we saw that movement actually during the Bush administration in the Pentagon. They wanted the Rumsfeld Pentagon that wanted to redefine this as the struggle against violent extremism, and that was deep-sixed by the White House, who said no. You know, I think they understood more clearly that if you're going to have war powers to pursue something, you better have a war. So they said, no, we're going to call it a war on terror because we want to have war powers. We want to have emergency powers. Well, at some point, you get into a real bind where you don't call it a war, but you still want to have, you know, drones flying around the world zapping people and a president claiming to have emergency powers when the emergency's over. There's just too many contradictions in this. And then you get in this whole budget issue and people tuning out and saying we've lost, and it's just a big mess.
Claude.
Actually, I think you... Yeah. Have you got me?
Gotcha.
All right, sorry, but what was the question? I thought it was the same question.
It is.
I'll take a pass. I think I started off on this question.
Yeah, I think I got a third.
Yeah.
We've kind of wandered into it. Tom, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
No, it's a tough one. I found it interesting that, that Jim's comments echo those by Eugene Robinson in the Post on the 7/38 about not calling this a war. That if there ever was, or there never was a war, but if there was, it's over and we won. I know that's not exactly what Jim is saying.
Yeah, that would be a first, by the way.
I was going to say, yeah,
I agree with him.
I found it intriguing. In any event, I've attended a couple of the ceremonies in the Pentagon, and then also at the command I had, because we lost 8 people in the Pentagon. And, you know, one thing I noticed was, you know, this is really a long war, like a cliche now, but it really is a long war. I think more comparable to the Cold War in many ways than it is to, which got, as we all know, hot at various times, and we maintained a focus on for a long time while we had to handle a whole lot of other little issues. But I think there are all this threat is going to continue as long as there are going to be people that ascribe to this form of, well, ascribe to terror and the belief that it's the way that the weak confront the strong as opposed to being, you know, an attack in essence on the weak because of the targets they go after. But I guess for me, and this is where I'm trying to keep the emotion out of it, you can't take your eye off the ball, and I have to go back to things I learned, you know, growing up in the back alleys of Baltimore as a kid. There's always somebody that wants your lunch money, and you're going to have to be vigilant all the time. Sometimes that's, you know, you fight, and sometimes you take a different route. And other times you walk with, you know, a number of guys, and you go out and prove that it's just, you know, too hard, which is back to an earlier question. I think another reason why the terrorists, if you look at al-Qaeda in particular, I mean, this is a very hard target now in the United States. But we can still, on any given day in the right circumstances, you know, anybody can still be had. But by golly, they got to work pretty darn hard, break quite a sweat to do it. Probably a terrible analogy back to my youth, but regardless, I think this begins with the recognition that this isn't going to go away, that we are going to have to be people, we are going to have people focused on it, that this kind of a threat has led to already here the creation of a kind of a reinterpretation of our national security structure, you know, away from just look, there's domestic security, and that's in the hands of the FBI and law enforcement and our top men. And then there is this threat, this away game. Those are sort of international threats and foreign threats, and that's in the purview of primarily the Department of Defense when it comes to nation states, and then also maybe the Central Intelligence Agency. But the realization that, hey, you know, we're going to have to really integrate these two, and there's going to have to be these new entities like the Department of Homeland Security that are going to have to broker this interaction and integration, you know, across the federal government. That I think that's where we are now, but I think in the future, the way we get around this is maybe it's time for a redefinition of the national security structure in the United States. Maybe the 1947 National Security Act and the laws, et cetera, Posse Comitatus and others that we faced. By golly, we brought down a lot of the firewall, but we've also realized we're right at the edge of what those statutes, what those laws allow us to do to defend the people of this nation. I'm not advocating radical reform. God knows we've heard enough of the dreaded R word necessarily, but I think, you know, we really need to rethink this or continue to rethink it. Things like the Project on National Security Reform addressed, I think, a lot of the key issues, and those guys are still around thinking hard about, so what would it take to get to a new definition of national security that encompasses the kinds of threats that, if you believe that they're going to be persistent, I happen to believe they're going to be, and it includes these terrorists. It also includes, you know, a highly sophisticated transnational organized crime threat that, my God, when you start throwing in people like Los Zetas in Mexico, that, boy, they sure resemble special forces more than they do criminals at sometimes. You kind of say, well, okay. But I guess the idea is you can't take your eye off the ball. You have to keep rethinking national security. You have to keep rethinking the laws and the foundations, our civil liberties that underpin all those laws. But to just declare, you can't declare victory and run up the victory pennant and go home. It's not going to go away. I think that's as naive as overreacting. What I tried to tell folks this week when I spoke with them, young analysts and guys in the national security field, it isn't going to be easy. You're going to have to think it through. It's going to be hard. And at some point, we're going to have to make some real decisions on what pieces stay and what pieces have to be melded, changed, or done away with. I'm sure that's another whole show, but that's the long-winded answer to your question.
Well, it's a good answer, and it fortunately prompts the next question I have to ask of Claude. I too watched. I didn't go to these ceremonies because I don't live around Washington, but I watched a lot of the ceremonies, and I find myself getting madder and madder as I watch. It just brought it all back to me. I mean, I got mad. So Claude, my first thing was to ask you whether we should have acted more vigorously and turned deserts into sheets of glass and completely bombed out people to back to the third century where they already are. But I've decided instead to ask you a question that has to do with your political science background. Here we are. We've got this. We got the war. The quote war winding down. We're bringing our troops home. Should we now have something like a Department of Perpetual national security threat issues, and if so, what do we do with the Constitution? How does this all fit together? And you've got a couple of minutes to try and figure this out and give me your best answer.
I don't know about creating yet another department. I'm not and again, my opinions are my own and not those of the Naval Academy, although sometimes I wish they were. I'm not a fan of creating more departments simply in response to issues. I think there are ways of reorganizing departments we already have, or even with, say, within the Navy, looking at future threats. Absolutely, I think there should be offices, and to some degree there are, that look at things in new and very different ways. And when you look at what's coming down the pike after Afghanistan and years afterward, you know, I think they'll look back on Afghanistan as saying, did we do this right? I mean, that's, again, Monday morning quarterbacking, but at lessons that we can learn for future conflicts. I think actually one of the things they're going to look at is Major Jim Gantt's One Tribe at a Time. It was about 45 or 50 pages. And I would encourage anybody who's listening to read One Tribe at a Time and what Major Jim Gantt did in Afghanistan with one of the local tribes, lived there for a couple of years, gained the trust of the locals with his team. And the point he makes is that, you know, when we're out of Afghanistan, Karzai probably won't be too far behind. because it's an unstable situation that's already being created. So I think even when Jim Gant's piece came out a couple of years ago, people were really starting to take a hard look at this. Certainly, again, we've had tremendous successes, but the way we could have successes in the future might depend on the mid to junior grade officers and enlisted who are thinking differently because they are growing up in a very different world, understand things like, you know, that Tom, Jim, and I may not have understood 10 years ago that might come down the pike, like things like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube that would have such wide-ranging implications not only in American politics but with coordinating events and revolutions or oppositions to the standard governments out in the Middle East. So, yeah, I think we should have some sort of team that looks at future threats in a very different way, no matter how different they look at it. And I'll give you an example. We talk a lot about cyber. That's probably one of the things that scares me most about the next thing down the pike. I hate to use science fiction as an example, but since a lot of things from science fiction in the past 50 years have often come to pass, you know, look at the Star Trek communicator. I'm holding right now in my hand an iPhone that does so many things that was unimaginable before. But if you look at the Battlestar Galactica reboot from about 5 or 6 years ago, how did the Cylons win that first battle? They basically got the codes and understood the software for all of our systems, the Colonial fleet systems, and shut the entire fleet down so that they could destroy them. And that's going to be a new way of warfare, and it could be part of this 21st century stateless war, if you will, where we see either states or other operatives, whether it's the Mexican cartels or somebody or terrorists or other criminal elements that are using newfound weapons against us. And over to you.
All right. Jim, you got thoughts along those lines?
I don't know that the future threats, the most serious threats, will necessarily be unconventionally based threats. I think that we're seeing a rise in problems with states. Iran is a critical example, since we, for some reason, are unwilling to do what we need to do to get the point across with Iran to stop their nuclear program. And once they have a nuclear program, once they have a nuclear weapon, then other countries in that region are going to follow suit. They've already said so. So this is going to create incredible instabilities that go beyond just the normal terrorism problems. It gets into and goes beyond just the nexus paradigm of, you know, a rogue state and a terrorist with their cat's paw with nuclear weapons attacking us. It gets into rogue states using nuclear weapons as instruments of their policy. I mean, not just using them like to have a one-shot detonation on Wall Street or something, but to intimidate us and to deter us from doing the things we need to do to maintain our influence in various regions where we want to be. So that future is pretty scary. The cyber future, as Claude mentioned, is really a problem, because I don't think we have a full understanding of how that whole system works. I mean, it evolves in ways that obviously it wasn't intended to in the first place, but in ways that we don't understand or don't detect or who knows what. I mean, when you have a teenager in the Philippines, this was a few years ago, but basically shutting down the internet for a day because he was screwing around with a virus, you know, and that wasn't even intentional. It was just he was messing around, and so suddenly things start shutting down. When you look at what the Chinese or the North Koreans could accomplish or anybody else through intentional attacks on our increasingly vulnerable and increasingly interconnected computer-based systems, it's really scary. The economic warfare potential of that, you know, forget shutting down our star fleets or something, but, just how about shutting down our banking system? Or how about someone figuring out a way to create a stock market crash.
Yeah.
Things like that. Sure. Just, or, you know, any scenario. This is very, very frightening stuff. So those are the kind of threats that we're going to have to look at in the future. And, you know, terrorism and unconventional warfare kind of tie into that because these are all kind of unconventional threats that we aren't necessarily configured to combat. But I also think that, and just the fact that we're talking about it here and others talk about it, I mean, there's an awareness out there that these threats are real. We just have to get our act together. Whether the Department of Homeland Security should have the lead on the cyber threat, you know, that's a, there's a debate. I don't think so. I don't think they have their act together enough to do that. And it may take a 9/11-style crisis in the cyber world to refocus our thinking and get us serious about that. But until there's a crisis, I think we'll muddle through and, you know, we'll do our best. But at some point, something really bad will happen, and then we'll get results.
Tom, your thoughts?
Again, I think they've been pretty well stated. You know, I worry a great deal. Even in the military today, with the advent of network-centric warfare, I mean, it really means that we are network-dependent. And you don't necessarily need a directed, focused weapon to go against the networks. As was pointed out in the Philippines story, you can get lucky with just a general virus or a persistent virus of some kind that you know, somebody just injects for the sheer grins that he takes from doing so. And again, it's also in many ways like you know, how many mines does it take, to use a naval analogy, an effective minefield? You know, it doesn't take any. It takes 50 cents to put in a payphone, you know, and say there is a mine in a particular area. Once there is even a reported threat of a virus or the first indications of one, no matter how persistent, and not just virus, but other cyber threats, then, you know, we start taking things down. And therefore, you know, our ability, our network-centric abilities or capabilities start to be denigrated. And it may just be that you have to take it down long enough to achieve a particular aim. So, yeah, tremendous things to be concerned about. You know, for me, the answer is you really do have to have people that are focused on, as Claudia said, a generation of folks that understand the mechanics of the tools, the motivations for people. And then you have to start figuring out, what your priorities are, but not become a slave we can only handle the top two priorities because of our limited resources. We can't play little kid soccer here. There still have to be people focused broadly. We're not going to do that with an all-encompassing intelligence entity or national security structure. We're going to have to rely on people in variety of industries, you know, whether it be the business intelligence group, businessmen in general, NGOs. How does this information come together? And the key kind of becomes, you know, we have someone aware of what we ought to be looking for, and then secondly, will we recognize it when we see it? And then we have the ability to integrate this massive amount of information that's out there now. We've made tremendous strides on that score, and we talk about information sharing, but you know, information sharing was almost obsolete by the time the phrase was coined. We're well beyond that in what's demanded. So how do you bring all of that together and raise the alarm, recognize the issue? There are a lot of smart people work looking at these issues, but there also has to be a will to step forward and say, okay, you know, this is the future. This is what we're going to have to do, and let's get on with the business of it. And let's cut down on the process, and let's focus more on the output. We do have a great deal with all of these structures. I'm particularly concerned about the cybersecurity structure of having, we've got a lot of balcony and very little Romeo, in my opinion.
And we're coming towards the end here. I want to do one of my favorite things is to ask everybody to give me a doctoral dissertation in 60 seconds or less. But, well, Tom, we'll start with you. Then we'll go to Jim and Claude. You know, anybody who's played football knows that if you're too focused on one part of the field, that's when you're going to get hit from behind. And for the last decade, we've been focused on combating Islamic extremism, however you want to describe it. While we've been more focused on that, what is the top one or two things you think from a national security perspective that we're missing that we need to try to wedge out some time to pay attention to?
I'll go first and keep it short. We really do need to look at China very hard. And for me, it's not an issue of looking at China, but it's having the will to accept what we're seeing and then to develop some sort of develop rational responses that are carrots and sticks and not just one or the other. We're not going to win the world just through engagement. I think even this administration's figured this out by now. There are a number of other trends that are developing that get very little attention that are going to impact, you know, the global economy. Fortunately, this is a maritime sort of focused discussion. So I think the Chief of Naval Operations correctly identified the Arctic, and that's a number of years out. But there are a number of things with the receding of the ice and the no longer exclusive routes owned by Russia or Canada for transiting the Arctic. But once the ice really goes as far back as it's doing much faster than anybody anticipated, shipping routes are going to be cut down, transit times, a lot of natural resources are now begun. It's going to be viable economically to go up there and look for it. And there are a number of states, including China, that have already staked it out. Russia's put its marker on the bottom and said, okay, all the mineral rights and et cetera to be found here belong to us. In this vast area. So there are a number of issues like that are out there that I don't think get all the attention that they should. Jim was right on nation states that we have to really keep a particularly close eye on, as they will develop nuclear weapons. And the bottom line is not only do we have to worry about what they'll do with them or blackmail us, but as in the case of Pakistan, we, as unstable as those governments are, we've got to know where those weapons are and have plans to, if no one else can, ensure that they aren't used to blackmail us or in a civil war even in a particular nation. And that's a whole job in its own right that doesn't get the attention, I think, that most people that doesn't get the attention of most people in the nation at this point.
Jim?
Well, I see we're almost out of time, so I'll just say the main thing I think we need to pay attention to, other than the things we've already mentioned, is space, competition in space, the degradation of our space program, and the potential for another 9/11 style strike, but it being against our space assets.
Claude.
Number one for me would be Yemen and collapse of Yemen, a new al-Qaeda base there, on what impact that would have truly on the Gulf of Aden, which would make piracy, a walk in the park. But what I think, just to add on to something said earlier, I think what they and everybody else are going to forget from 9/11, the lesson that we learned is that we had key leaders in positions. Most importantly, we had the courage of the American people, whether it was United Flight 93 or the firefighters going up those stairs. That's what they will underestimate yet again. We may get hit again, but we will respond like Americans do.
And on that note, Claude, thank you very much. Tom, Jim, Claude, thank you for coming on this Sunday evening, 10th anniversary of September 11th, to talk about the last decade. It's been a very fast 90 minutes and a very enjoyable conversation.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you much.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us. We hope to see you next time on MidRats. And till then, give your loved ones a hug and have a great Navy Day.
Leave the strand and Piccadilly for you.